Hello and welcome to The Stack this week. Some exciting news from the team behind Racket magazine. They have a new book out with the best writing from their first 3 years. Plus, a cool Singaporean title called Meantime and a magazine that is all about the crafts. Stay tuned. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis, and I am Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Coming up on the show, we speak to the editor of Meantime magazine and with the editor of Crafts magazine. But first on the show, I catch up with the team behind Racket magazine, David Shafto and Caitlin Thompson. We've been chronicling the story of the amazing tennis title since their launch, and now they have a new book out with the best writing from their first 3 years. I spoke to Dan while they were at the historic Orange Lawn Tennis Club, next to the grass courts.
Day one, you know, we always wanted to do other things besides the magazine, and especially make books and just make printed products of any kind. The thinking behind the book was that the magazine is, you know, it's colorful, it's printed product, it's a premium product, it's pretty firmly within the world of independent magazines, and that's the space it occupies. So this book allows us to have a mass market product and get us into some places where the magazine isn't, and allow it to be seen by a totally different audience and introduce people to the magazine. But, you know, we always wanted to do it, and we thought as soon as we have enough material to sort of do a best writing from Racket, we would go ahead and do it. So that's what the book is. It's some of our favorite pieces from the first 4 years of the magazine. And then we've commissioned one original piece, the piece that leads off the book. It's sort of the quintessential Racket piece that you'd find in the magazine. Everyone's heard of tennis legend Rod Laver. Well, we give you a piece about Rod Laver's ne'er-do-well nephew, who lives a chaotic life and eventually makes good. You know, it's a mass market product, but it's still got the sort of quirkiness and surprise of the kind of things you'd find in the magazine.
Well, and that's precisely one of my favorite things about Racket. One thing that I really admired, even if you're not, you know, a huge tennis fan or you don't know everything about that world, I think you can still be entertained about the type of stories. And Caitlin, how fascinating. I mean, 4 years of the magazine, and it feels so consistent. Which issue are you guys in? Issue 14 now, right?
Exactly. We just released issue 14, kind of at the same time as the book. We feel like the book and the magazine sort of occupy two different functions. As Dave said, this is a chance for us to get into bookstores, into readers' hands who might not be in the sort of cadence of our quarterly magazine. But the magazine really is a living and breathing and evolving entity. We want to speak to what's happening in the world of tennis that is inclusive, of course, of the professional tennis world, but not limited to it. As Dave said, Rod Laver's nephew is a story that we would have in any issue of the magazine, because we want to introduce culture, spectacle, whimsy, mystery, noir. We are really trying to play with the fact that tennis is our jumping off point. And the latest issue, of course, is no different. It's a little bit different in the sense that we have had, while we were making it, very little tennis to watch. There were some exhibitions in the past couple of months. But for the most part, we really sort of tried to contemplate with this issue number 14, the idea of solitary pursuits. Tennis is a game that is perfect for our times. It's pugilistic, but it's actually pretty solitary. Two people out there, but you're alone. And we kind of had some meditations and used it as a meta theme to contemplate playing against the wall, being on vacation, but actually not being able to escape yourself. The idea that tennis can take you to these very interesting places is always what we've tried to do and have be the through line of all of our different projects. So the issue and the book both speak to those things very much, which is tennis gives us an opportunity to talk about broader issues and ideas around, you know, the existence of being a human being. And I think that's what I remain proud of it and the book for doing, because I think they both do it quite well.
Well, very much so. And in some of the stories in the books, through the scope of tennis, you deal with important topics. For example, this perception that tennis might be a little bit elitist as well. But you also have very fun pieces, like David, for example, the Andre Agassi private jet kind of story. I mean, that was quite entertaining, actually, to read.
Thank you. Yeah, that's another perfect Racket story. Jason Biggs, who wrote it, is an actor. He never really written anything before, but had this story he wanted to tell. And it's a father and son story, where the jumping off point is tennis. And this was one of those things where you're like, well, this person's, you know, they're not a writer. I'll give them a try. And it's just one of my favorite pieces. It's so well realized. It was so cleanly written, which Jason will be pleased to hear. Just a really professional job. But also, again, the quintessential Racket story, Andre Agassi's plane is the jumping off point. And we're talking about his relationship with his dad. So to your point, it's not really about tennis, but it's appealing to people who might not understand tennis. And that's what we want to do. We want someone who doesn't follow the game or even play the game to use our magazine, or in this case, the book, as something that helps them get involved in the game and want them to participate.
And Caitlin, tell us perhaps some of the other stories that are in the book. I know you have a story actually that you've done there that is in the book as well.
Yeah, I actually do have a story, and it kind of is a nice sort of accompaniment to the piece that David just talked about, because it's about Andre Agassi's coach, one of his most famous coaches, Nick Bollettieri. And just for the record, you know, I'm the publisher of the magazine. David really leads most of our editorial efforts, and I do a lot of other things. Writing is not something I do often, but in this case, the story behind the piece that's in the book is actually kind of interesting and maybe gives you some insight into how we make it. The magazine is very much intended to inspire, and I think it's safe to say that it inspires both of us in the making of it too. We're inspired to make our love of tennis translate, as Dave just said. So I think in that case, we knew we wanted to include something on Nick Bollettieri. He's a legend. He's been responsible for the creation of a lot of stars. The Williams sisters arguably got their start there. Boris Becker came through, Monica Seles, Maria Sharapova, obviously Agassi being the first megastar. And what was amazing to us is kind of as we were closing the issue that appeared in, I believe it was issue 6, we were holding a story for Extra Room, and we got all of a sudden photos that a correspondent had taken in the sort of collapsing empire of Nick Bollettieri's Florida compound. And they weren't actually even particularly good photos, but they were interesting, and they gave us a chance to kind of delve into, wow, this guy kind of built something out of sand. He's not really even a very good tennis player. He was a paratrooper who came back from the war and decided to make something of himself, barked loud, took off his shirt, and managed to create sort of a mecca for tennis players in the 90s. Andre Agassi came through, created a juggernaut star, and I happened to go through there in the late 90s myself as a junior. And really what my story was we needed more information to sort of support these photos that we had been sent. And we thought, okay, well, now we can set aside the story that we were going to hold anyway and create a package around Nick Bollettieri. And instead of writing captions, which is what I was originally supposed to write, the story just kind of poured out of me thinking about my start in tennis and how sort of the joyousness of it was at times threatened by having a lot of male figures yelling at me. And that was sort of Nick Bollettieri's style. I was shown Nick Bollettieri's videos as a kid. And so this is all a long way of saying this was my personal meditation on what the sport meant to me, sort of my evolution, and we tied it together with this Nick Bollettieri package in a way that, again, allowed us, I think, to really stretch out beyond the kinds of things that normally get talked about if you're talking about a megastar like him.
I'd also like to add to this anecdote. We were talking about what to do with this Bollettieri package, and there was a documentary out at the time, and everyone was talking to him. And Caitlin mentioned this anecdote, and I literally, without exaggeration, locked her in a room and said, "You have 1 hour to write this piece." And she came out in 45 minutes with it finished and perfect.
Not our usual editorial process, to be sure. But again, magazine and the making of can surprise us in ways that we always want to feel alive. And so I think this story represents that. People, we work with a lot of writers, and in this case, myself, who don't cover tennis week in and week out very much. That's not a typical writer for us. And so one of the things that allows us to do is really be receptive and nimble and sort of see where someone takes us. In this case, it was me, and I didn't know until Dave locked me in that room where I was going to take us, but it took us to an interesting and sort of, for me, cathartic place. So I was really pleased when he asked if I would be up for including it in the anthology, because I didn't really think much of it, but it seemed to resonate. And that made me really, really pleased, and also really feeling like what we were doing with Racket was providing this platform for all sorts of different kinds of narratives.
And one question that I need to ask both of you, of course, your magazine is very much loved by us here from the Stack. And how has the relationship with your readers changed during lockdown? I mean, because it's quite interesting. It's been a challenging period in terms of places to sell because some newsstands were closed. But how did it work out for you guys, this process? Was it quite stressful, or perhaps an opportunity for you to change a few things or change the content? Because as you rightly said, there was no tennis for quite a few months, actually.
we did too much during the 5 months since this all began to really even get into here. But tennis was always seen as something that you could do by yourself. There was a lot of talk early on, like, is it safe to play tennis against someone? And we sort of decided that, you know, maybe it is, but we don't want to be the people telling everyone to break quarantine and go out there. But you have the wall, you are playing against the wall. And a lot of people started doing that. And we started hearing from those people, and they're communicating with us on social media. So tennis had this great intrinsic exercise hitting against the wall that everyone went back to, including us. So it was a way to, you know, it was something people felt they could do. And then, of course, when quarantine started easing, it was one of the first sports people decided that it was safe to go out and do. So tennis itself has kind of had a little mini renaissance in the last 5 months, certainly in New York. And then as far as making the magazine, you know, we couldn't do photo shoots. There was no tennis to cover. So we just said, let's do stories that explore the times we're living in, which Caitlin spoke to before. One of our writers reviewed 7 tennis murder mysteries. They were all terrible, but he had, you know, it was a fun story. Andrea Petkovic, who's a professional tennis player, talked about doing rehab alone in the Maldives and how horrible that was for her. So we just decided, let's look into the solitary nature of the sport, as Caitlin alluded to. So that issue reflects our times, but also what we could do. We couldn't schedule a photo shoot. We couldn't go to a tennis tournament. We couldn't play tennis. So we just used the moment, which frankly, I hope we always do, no matter what's going on in the culture.
Yeah, and I would just add that more people than ever are reading our magazine, which makes us obviously happy from a business standpoint, but just as a way to take a minute, take a beat, take a breather, and sit with something that's a little bit more meditative, maybe a little bit more esoteric. And I'm sure you've heard this, Fernando, from a lot of the magazine folks you talk to on this show, is readership is up generally because people are finding the joy in reading. And I know that that sounds like such a simple and obvious sort of statement, but for us, being a media entity around this sport that can at times feel so immediate. What was the score? What's the break? Who's leading? Who's going to be in the tournament tomorrow? And instead taking this approach like, oh, well, tennis is already a sort of meditative, interesting community and cultural experience for us. And so having this moment now where people were kind of on our same wavelength felt really good. And I hope it continues, because I hope people keep reading printed material in their hands because it makes them feel a certain way. And that's certainly what we designed the magazine when we're commissioning it and creating it for. So my hope is that that will continue no matter what.
That was David Shafto and Caitlin Thompson from Racket Magazine. Their latest issue is out now, and so is their book, Racket, the Book. We head to Singapore now to speak with the editor of Meantime magazine. The annual title documents Singapore stories lost to time. In each issue, they uncover the country's past through personal stories. Last year's issue was all about love stories, but in the new issue, the theme is ghosts. Let's hear from the title's editor, Peng Shukyang, for more.
Meantime is an independent magazine that's based in Singapore. And basically, we collect stories that are lost to time. A lot of the stories that we collect in Meantime, they actually showcase people and places that sort of history has forgotten these things. Why we chose Meantime as a title is because there are two reasons. Number one is that we wanted to talk about how time is mean, in that the passing of time, it's sort of like a malignant force where because of the passing of time, things get lost, things are forgotten. So that's one reason. And another reason is that we like the idea of in the meantime, which is like urging readers to sort of pause, to reflect, to take a moment to, I guess, notice that there are actually these stories that are happening.
Well, and that's what I did when I was reading this issue here. And I love that the theme for issue 2 was ghosts. I mean, it's funny, I was talking to friends about the topic because, some people believe it, some people don't. It's always like, you know, it's such an interesting topic for discussion. But again, you had so many interpretations of that word. Why did you choose ghost stories?
Okay, for those of you who don't know, our first issue was on love stories. So we use stories to explore Singapore. View stories to explore this place and this country, Singapore. So for the first issue, we talked about love. We were very interested in personal stories. So we started with love because everyone sort of has a love story. And when we talk to people about their love story, we sort of get deeper and more intimate. So that was the first issue, and we had a great time discussing about love. And we thought that what was another topic that was personal? What was another topic that we could go deep and that people can open up themselves and to share more about their lives? And we thought that if we talk about things that haunt us when we are being vulnerable, when we talk about our fears, when we talk about things that we're afraid of, we realize that this is also a topic that allows us to really go deep and to open our hearts. We like the concept of ghosts because ghosts do not necessarily have to be scary. It could be things that we think about in our mind all the time, or things that linger, or things that haunt us. So we were very fascinated with the idea of ghosts.
Well, I absolutely love those stories. But before we talk about some of the other stories on the new issue, let's talk about the cover and the whole design. I love the handmade elements of your magazine as well. So tell us a bit more about that.
So we were really ambitious in that when we decided to do a print magazine, we didn't want to do something that was standard, like a standard magazine, like a standard size. So we thought that we wanted to push the boundaries of print. If people were to buy our magazine, we wanted to give them more reasons to buy it. So we decided to incorporate lots of handmade elements. So for the second issue, we had torn chapter dividers. So every chapter divider was hand torn and they looked different because of that. And then the edges of the magazine is also jagged. So we actually use sort of like this little knife to like make it jagged, to make it more tactile. So when people are reading it, it feels as if someone has already touched it.
So that's what you did, Peng. Mm. Oh my God, I'm so surprised because I did notice. I was like, oh, my copy had a little thing, but it's so much easier to read. Wow.
Yeah.
Thanks for letting me know.
No worries. Yeah, so there are all these little print surprises. I guess people, it's just a little... Yeah, like a little surprise where people might realize or they may not, I don't know. Yeah, and I guess that goes to the main sort of like the biggest surprise, I guess, which is the cover of the magazine. We treated it with this layer of heat-sensitive ink where if you hold it in your hands for a long time, the color actually changes. It reacts to your heat, basically. And we thought this was really fascinating because it relates to the idea of ghost, because you can have an imprint of your hand on the cover. And at the same time, it also shows that if you incorporate some human elements or you incorporate warmth or life, you actually reveal things.
And I love one of the stories. It's kind of a photography story as well, about the Hopar Park. I mean, this is fascinating, no?
It is. So it's really interesting because the Hopar Villa is like, I think it is a park that was built before Singapore was independent. So it stood the test of time. At the moment now, it's sort of a little bit abandoned, but it stays the same for a long like decades, like for half a century, I think. There are a lot of statues, weird statues that depict hell, like this idea of hell in Chinese mythology, the 18 levels of hell where people who don't go to heaven, people who perhaps have done something bad in this current life, in their mortal life, get condemned to hell. And so that place depicts all these strange statues, yet even though it's all abandoned, the park still remains there. Yeah, so it's really fascinating.
And finally, Peng, I just would like to ask, how is it to make a magazine in Singapore? Do you think it's a thriving place for indie magazines or when it comes to the world of print in general?
That's a very interesting question. In Singapore, like, fun fact, there are so few publications in terms of like mainstream publishing. There are only 2 printed newspapers in the entire country.
Wow.
So yeah, there are only 2 printed newspapers. And because of that, the censorship and state censorship and press freedom. So there's a lot of state censorship and there's very little press freedom. And because of that, a lot of artists, a lot of writers return to self-publishing or independent publishing to really showcase our creativity and our ideas. And I think because of that, the independent magazine scene in Singapore is small, but it's really thriving. And it's where you're able to really get to know the country, get to know the people, you get to know the country, and you get to see the creativity from there. Whereas from our newspapers and our main publications, there is like an overarching narrative that is sort of dictated and decided by the government. So it is a little bit stale and it's not as vibrant as the independent or the self-publishing scene.
That was Bang Shukyang from Mingtime Magazine. Issue 2 is out now. And finally on the show, a new look for Crafts Magazine. The title always spotlights today's most exciting makers, from a fashion designer redefining West African weaving to how makers have reshaped their practices in isolation. The title has it all. I spoke to Crafts editor Malaika Bing for more.
It was first published in 1973, so it's got a long history. And over that time, it's really built up a reputation globally for being the authority on craft. It sold all around the world. And now it's got a new chapter, starting with the September-October issue, the whole new look and feel and a fresh approach to content as well. So it's an exciting time for the magazine.
So tell us, what were the main changes? And also, I just want to know, since when have you been working for Crafts?
I began editing Crafts at the end of 2018. And obviously, as a new editor, you long to be able to transform an issue straight off. But there are various reasons why I couldn't. But in a funny way, it's actually been quite nice because it's a bit like moving into a new house. It's quite nice to be able to live with it for a bit and then decide what to change, what you like and what you don't. Also, because I previously was working more in the design and architecture spheres, although there was a big crossover with Crafts, it was nice to be able to get under the skin of the sector before I really looked at reinventing the magazine. Just to give you a bit of background, I mean, the magazine's got almost 50-year history, but in that time, the market for craft has massively changed. So it has a much bigger kind of consumer market now. Craft also has the highest engagement in the population of all the arts. So you can see that there's a huge potential there for attracting new audiences. The Crafts Council itself recently did a massive report into the market for the craft, in which it showed that a whopping figure, like 70% of the population, have bought a crafted object last year. And there's a much younger audience for craft as well. There's a much younger demographic of collectors, which is really interesting. So that's something that we very much tried to reflect in the look and feel of the magazine and also the contents themselves. I hate to use the word prosumer because it's a horrible word, but it sort of reflects that in the past, our audience has been chiefly people within the craft world, and we want to really open that up to a much broader audience. In terms of the contents, like I said, we already have an international audience, but we want to grow that massively. So the contents of the issue is from all over the world, and our contributors are also from all over the world. Doing shoots during lockdown in Nigeria and rural Mexico was quite a challenge, but I think it's paid off, hopefully. But in terms of the contents, I want to show how craft is relevant to all areas of life. It can enhance all areas of life. So the magazine sort of explores the intersection between craft, design, architecture, fashion, and even science. I feel like craft has always been a barometer of the times. Craftspeople have always used their work as a vehicle to critique politics and social issues. So I want to really put a focus on that. And it feels right for the magazine at this important time to be much more reflective of the world around it and sort of commenting on the context. So the first issue we've called the Changemakers issue, and it celebrates the power of craft to change people's lives and bring people together. So the changemakers we see as the people who are using craft skills and practices to make an impact, whether that's socially, ecologically, or politically.
Well, and again, one thing that you mentioned that is very true, crafts is definitely don't have only kind of the UK outlook when it comes to the craft industry. It's so international. There's a lovely story with Fernando Lapos in Mexico, Kenneth Eyes as well, who is doing a lot of interesting things with West African weaving. I quite like that aspect of the magazine. And Malaika, how do you see the craft industry changes during the pandemic as well? I mean, it's been a hard period for many industries. How did it affect craft?
It's been obviously hard for everybody. In terms of makers, I mean, a lot of people have been unable to access their studios or materials, which has been obviously hugely problematic. And of course, for graduates, it's all the worst because they haven't been able to have their graduate shows. So we actually have taken a lot of strides to give the spotlight to the latest cohort of graduates, and we'll continue to do that over the following issues. In terms of more established makers, the US critic and curator Glenn Adamson has written a really interesting piece for this issue on how artists in the US have had to adapt their practices in light of COVID, but also some of the positives that that has brought in terms of the kind of work they're doing and the people that they're engaging with. So yeah, of course, a lot of negatives, but some really positive things have come out of it too.
And tell us about your readers. I mean, you mentioned that they're also quite international. Do you still have very much kind of a subscription-based readers, or is it mainly a newsstand sales? I'm always curious about that.
Subscribers still make up the core of our readership. But we sell a lot through specialist shops and galleries. We are on the newsstand. And actually, from this issue, we are now going to be stocked in Waitrose. So that's a change for this issue. And it kind of reflects the new positioning of the magazine. I think what's quite interesting at the moment is people are shopping less. But when they do, they shop in bigger bulk. So being in Waitrose right now, I think it's a good slot for the magazine. But obviously, we're putting quite a lot of focus on sales through digital platforms. And we also have a digital issue, a digital edition of the magazine on Exact Editions.
That was Malaika Bing from Crafts Magazine. Their September-October issue is out now. Well, that's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Jack Jewers. If you have any comments or queries, feel free to write to me, Fernando, at fp@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at the same time. And of course, you can always listen to it again at monocle.com or subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and SoundCloud. Before we go, a little song for you. This is New Order with Crafty, remixed by DJ Dan. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Until next time, it's goodbye from me.